You're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. 2 weeks ago, we shared our first episode of a special three-part podcast series about the Microbiology Society's policy project, A Sustainable Future. These episodes discuss how microbiology can be used to tackle some of the global challenges set out in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. In our previous episode, my colleague Hannah spoke with microbiologists conducting research in the field of soil health. And now it's time for policy manager Eva to find out more about how microbiology can be used to move towards a circular economy.
Thank you very much for joining us today as we discuss the importance of the circular economy for the Sustainable Development Goals and the crucial role that microbiology plays in this area. As we will hear in more detail during this episode, the circular economy holds particular promises for achieving multiple SDGs, including affordable and clean energy, SDG 7, decent work economic growth, SDG 8, responsible consumption and production, SDG 12, and climate action, SDG 13. Today we will be talking to two scientists working in the area of circular economy. Professor Alison Smith from the University of Cambridge and Emilia Rusick from the University of Manchester. Our first guest today is Professor Alison Smith, who heads the Department of Plant Sciences at the University of Cambridge. Today she will be talking to us about her work on the use of microalgae in circular processes and how engaging with stakeholders can benefit science. Hi Alison, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. First of all, can you tell me a bit about your research and how it relates to the circular economy?
My real interest is in metabolism, how plants and microorganisms make interesting chemicals. And I find the whole thing incredibly fascinating. And I'm particularly focused on vitamins. And vitamins are micronutrients which organisms need. They can't get from their own metabolism, and they need them as cofactors for their enzymes. So that's the sort of basis of my fundamental research. But over the years, I've done all sorts of things, always wanting to do research, fundamental research, which nonetheless has some application in the real world, some use in the real world. In the last, say, 20 years, our focus has been working with algae, microalgae, which are photosynthetic organisms and therefore offer the means to more sustainable processes than you might get through using microorganisms that are non-photosynthetic and need a source of fixed carbon. So the concept of the circular economy, I've always been aware of it, but I've never really thought about that in the context of what I do, which is molecular biology and biochemistry, and it's very sort of detailed knowledge. But it became clear when I started to interact with industry a bit more in the area of using microalgae that there's an untapped potential that you can use these organisms in innovative ways. People have just not thought about the options, or they have thought about them, but perhaps in a sort of low-tech way. And so I'm trying to marry the two aspects together, the high-tech biotechnology side with the slightly more mundane but actually equally important sustainability side.
Have the Sustainable Development Goals impacted your work in this area?
Obviously, the Sustainable Development Goals have come up and been modified basically since the millennium, but I find them very helpful in terms of trying to think about the way in which one can apply one's research. And the sustainability goals that I really focus on are basically nutrition. And zero hunger is sustainable goal two. But hunger can be lack of calories, but actually also lack of nutrition. And that's where the vitamin side comes in. So that's what I have really been focused on in the last few years. But I think our work on trying to think about how to use microalgae in circular processes impacts on several other things, including agriculture and clean water and avoiding pollution by being able to remediate waste streams.
You mentioned that an aspect of your work is to investigate the potential of algae as a source of bioenergy. Bioenergy can positively contribute to climate goals and rural livelihoods, but what could potentially happen if some of those opportunities are not carefully implemented?
I said at the beginning, I qualified my comment about microalgae being photosynthetic and therefore sustainable. Things are only sustainable in the round, and particularly in the context of inputs and outputs. So simply because they photosynthesize does not mean that there aren't more inputs in other ways that you would have to use in order to cultivate them, such as energy for circulating the liquid that they're in, the embodied energy that you have in the photobioreactors or other vessels in which you're cultivating these organisms. There might be changes to land use. There might be a need for nitrogen fertilizer. Where do you get that from? And so on. So you have to think about the process completely, do a complete life cycle assessment. And that's something which I think is really important in all processes, but particularly if you're claiming that what you're doing is sustainable or contributing to the circular economy. So as far as biofuels is concerned, that was really how I started getting into algal biotechnology about sort of 15, 20 years ago. And I could never quite understand how people thought that you could use algae for biofuels, given the fact that we have very little experience of growing them at scale. The largest algal cultivation systems are a few tens of hectares. And in order to produce enough algal biomass to make biofuel, you need tens of thousands of hectares, and you'd have to be cultivating them continuously. And there's just no agronomic expertise that would enable that to happen. And it seems to me it'd be much more sensible to start at something which is much higher value and much smaller scale, and you can get the know-how and maybe you can move forward into biofuels. Particularly for biofuels, it's completely ironic if you're trying to produce energy, but the amount of energy that you have to put in to get it is a lot more than you get out. That makes it completely pointless. I mean, it's not even sensible to think about doing.
Talking about different sets of stakeholders, what do you think the role of scientists is in ensuring policymakers are making the right decisions when it comes to alternatives to the fossil fuel-based economy?
Yeah, so I think one of the things, I think many people in biology use mathematical approaches, computational approaches, physical sciences, and they interact with their academic colleagues in these areas, and I do indeed myself. But in terms of actually doing anything that is deployable, that you can commercialize, you need to have a sense of actual production. So interacting with engineers has been the sort of eye-opener. They are so much more focused than discovery scientists on getting something to work rather than finding out how it works. So, you know, I'm fascinated by metabolism. I want to know how metabolism works, but actually in some ways it's slightly irrelevant if you can get your system, your organism or whatever it is, to produce something. So it's actually talking to people who come at problems from a completely different perspective provides, you know, a reality check. Then when you start to talk to people in the industrial world and in the commercial world, and then they say, well, I don't care how clever your system is, there's no market. Or, well, there is a market, but there are these six big companies and they have the whole market share. And how is your little idea going to insert into that?
Talking about different sets of stakeholders, what do you think the role of scientists is in ensuring policymakers are making the right decisions when it comes to alternatives to the fossil fuel-based economy? Should the worlds of science and policy be separated, or can they come together on occasion?
No, I think it should come together, but I think even experts don't agree with one another. And that's actually the scientific method. And, you know, there's another irony that at the moment, lots of people who dismissed experts in principle, like we don't need them because we're the policymakers, are now desperate to have as many experts as possible. But the experts don't necessarily agree with one another. And if they did agree with one another, then I would be really worried. There isn't a clear answer to this problem. And even if there was an answer, it won't be the only one. There's never one solution to any one problem because there are so many things you have to take into account. So the important thing is to be familiar with the idea of gathering evidence, assessing evidence, and then weighing up which is the most likely explanation or solution or something. And then you've got to then take the decision in the context, which is not scientific, you know, it's societal, it's economic, and so on. This sort of constant requirement for a black and white answer, which I think it's really, really difficult. And I think so. That's a very long-winded answer to your question. A short version is, yes, I think scientists should engage with policy because they provide the information and data that enables policymakers to make their decisions in an informed way.
My final question is a rather ambitious one. What do you see as the next big thing in the circular economy? And can we achieve this by 2030, the official deadline to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals?
I think the circular economy will need to be a bit more rapid because it will be one of the main pillars of our strategy to try to reduce carbon emissions. And we have to be a lot more sustainable in terms of our primary production. And agriculture is a very good example of that because that uses a lot of energy. And it's done at scale, and it would be possible to imagine having a better mix of not so much input, not necessarily so much output, or not so much perfect output. The circular economy will move forward, and I think that should be up there in the list of priorities.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today and telling us all about your research. It was so interesting. Our second guest today is Emilia Wojcik, a PhD researcher from the University of Manchester. Emilia's PhD is focused on protein and metabolic engineering for biofuels production. And today we will be chatting about some of the challenges encountered by scientists working on protein and about the importance of collaborating with industry. Hi Emilia, thank you for joining me today. First of all, can you please tell me a bit more about your background and your PhD?
My background is in molecular and cellular biology. That's what my undergraduate degree was in. I'm currently a third year PhD student at the University of Manchester. When I was an undergraduate, I did a year in industry and I worked on producing biofuel ethanol from lignocellulose, which is a waste plant material. And that kind of sparked my interest in turning waste really into useful compounds using synthetic biology, which is engineering microorganisms to have novel functions. And since then, I've had an interest in that. And during my PhD, I work within a team of scientists who are trying to make components of LPG, which is a useful fuel from waste materials using different biological methods. So that's kind of been the overall purpose of my research, really.
What sort of questions are you seeking to answer as part of this project?
The general question that my research and the research of my colleagues is trying to answer is whether we can make the chemicals that make up LPG using bacteria, essentially, and can we make this a more environmentally friendly process than it currently is. I personally work on one protein called fatty acid photodecarboxylase, or FAP. And this protein in nature makes long alkanes, which are the components of petrol. But the components of LPG are short alkanes. So during my PhD, basically, I've been trying to do some protein engineering to see if we can make this protein better at making the short alkanes that then go into LPG. The answer is yes, we can. And during my PhD, I've made several protein variants that are better than the wild-type protein at making propane in particular. But other scientists in my group are also working on butane, which is the other component of LPG, developing new hosts that can work with a range of waste materials. It's a very big project with a wide scope.
Are you facing any particular challenges?
I think the biggest challenge that researchers who work on producing a certain type of compound using bacteria or any kind of biological method, really, the challenge that these researchers face is whether that compound can be produced on a large scale and whether it can be economically viable to produce it. I think that differs like from compound to compound, but in my research team, we think that we can if the process to make the components of LPG is modified in certain ways. So for example, an obvious one is to improve the efficiency of the process, but also using cheap waste feedstocks or selling of some of the byproducts.
Knowing this already, how early on did you start collaborating with industry?
In my group, we work with a company called C3 Biotechnologies, and we've been collaborating with them since the beginning of the project to try and make this process as economically feasible as is possible. And yeah, as I said, there's a lot of scientists working on this project, and we're all basically trying to think of ways to maximize the output of the chemicals. Ultimately, the goal is to hopefully try and make a more sustainable fuel that people can use.
How does your research address some of the UN Sustainable Development Goals?
I think my research relates to the responsible consumption and production and also climate action. My research personally, but also the research of the team that I work within, because while burning LPG still produces greenhouse gases, it's a relatively clean burning fuel when you compare it to like petrol, for example. There's also other people in my group working on converting basically CO2 to LPG components using cyanobacteria and the enzyme FAP. And I think something like that process, which is kind of entirely circular, definitely relates to those two goals. But also the wider purpose of the project, which is to make a more sustainable fuel, is also relevant.
What do you see as the next big thing in your research area in the next 10 years?
Probably carbon capture technologies are going to become very big. As I said, some people in our group are working on trying to capture CO2 and kind of fit that into the whole process of trying to produce LPG. But I think that's something a lot of people are going to start working on and trying to focus on actively removing CO2 from the atmosphere rather than just trying to make carbon neutral fuels.
Thank you very much, Emilia, for such an interesting chat and for telling us more about the work you and your team are doing at the University of Manchester. Thank you so much to both of our guests today on this special episode of Microbe Talk. It was great to hear about two different areas of the circular economy and how important it is to the Sustainable Development Goals. Remember, if your research relates to the circular economy and you would like to be involved in our Sustainable Future project, then please get in touch. We are collecting case studies on research in this area, and we would like to hear from you. Please visit our website for more information. Thanks again for listening today, and look out for our next episode in this series, where we will be talking to Professor Laura Piddock from the University of Birmingham and Dr. Anne Leonard from the University of Exeter about addressing antimicrobial resistance and the Sustainable Development Goals.